Previously on The Storyteller, Naked Villainy, a strong opening to The Crown's closing.
A letter of a death foretold.
The jury is reminded of Brenda's violent end.
This lady died as a result of a violent assault. She had been struck in the face, head, at least 20 times by a blunt instrument, which fractured the base of the skull.
And the sinister warning Brenda gave to many people.
If he killed her, he would do it so that nobody would know.
It's taken 45 years to bring a killer to court. And for the first time in UK history, you'll hear the full murder trial and witness justice being done. It was a brutal murder of a brilliant woman who was a rising star in genetic research.
It would now be almost like a script from Morse. The investigators swarming over the dreaming spires of university land.
There was kind of palpable feeling of evil in the air.
I was told it was just a mass of blood and hair.
2 decades on from confronting evil.
Well, did you kill your ex-wife, Brenda Page?
Evil is being confronted by the law.
Did you kill her?
No.
She knew it was coming.
He said he was going to kill her.
If he killed her, he would do it so that nobody would know.
Will his true nature be unmasked?
Are you familiar with the tale of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde?
And can Brenda's own words help secure her killer's fate?
A letter of a death foretold.
This is The Storyteller, Naked Villainy, written, produced and edited by me, Isla Traquair. Courtroom 1 was warm, and the jury, press and public alike, were making an effort to pay attention and absorb the words of Advocate Deputy Alec Prentice as he wove the extensive evidence through his closing speech. He'd laid the groundwork for how compelling circumstantial evidence could be when looked at as a whole, and he'd reminded the jury of the extreme level of violence used to kill Brenda. Next, he began to layer the key parts of witness testimony, along with the forensic clues linking Kit to the crime scene, the paint flecks from his car, and the sperm on the blood-soaked sheets. We'll rejoin at the point where the AD goes over one of the most important and contentious witnesses, Kit Harrison's own friend.
You'll recall the evidence of Elsa Christie, who said that on the day before, or the day before that, on which Brenda was found, there was a telephone call. Brenda with Kit Harrison. Now, Elsa Christie does not appear to be a close friend or companion of Brenda Page. The connection was Kit Harrison, not Brenda Page. As you'll recall, Elsa Christie's husband and Kit Harrison had a love of books. And Elsa Christie said, and it's, you need to determine whether you accept this or not, it's entirely your province, that Kit Harrison was very angry. Now, does that chime with anyone else observing conduct of Kit Harrison? Very angry, and said he was going to kill her. Now, first of all, do you accept that that was said? It was properly pointed out that in the first statement taken by the police, that was not included. But you heard from Elsa Christie, who was adamant it was said, and she remembered it. Now, of course, you can take the view, well, I don't believe her. Don't think that was said. That's made up. Do you think that? Do you think she came, took an oath, and faced you and told you that when it's a complete lie in a murder trial? Of course, it's not impossible. You decide. But when you look at evidence not in isolation, but in the wider picture, has anyone else ever said anything of that nature? Does that help you in assessing whether you're prepared to accept that evidence? So if you decide that it was said, of course, applying your common sense, people say these things. Something happens, I'll kill you for that. Just wait till I see him, I'll kill him. They don't mean it. It's never meant literally. Except on this occasion, a day or two later, Brenda Page is dead. And it's against that background of what I suggest is coercive and violent behaviour. Against the background of Brenda Page expressing a real, and I suggest, deep-rooted fear of being killed that caused her to write that letter to her solicitor, to send a will at one point to her sister, which in which the beneficiaries was her sister, not her husband at the time. Dr. Jesse Watt told you about the Vienna conference. Now, of course, that's an aspect of the evidence that we know there's an interdict against Kit Harrison, so why are they being together in defiance of the order? And Brenda Page would know that. She sought the order. But that goes back to the complex nature of human relations. And she told you that... Sorry, Dr. Watt told you that despite them being there, Brenda Page was miserable and didn't want to see him. Is this an example of Brenda Page just trying to appease the situation? Or is it an elaborate deception that all these things that she was telling people and showing injuries and talking about adjusting haircuts and things all made up, when the truth is none of this happened, they were to be together? I suggest that's nonsense. Brenda Page told Dr. Watt that she was convinced that Kit Harrison would follow her when working as an escort, and she would take a double trip when driving. Now, don't look at evidence in isolation. There's a little comment made which might not be all that important to Jesse Watt at the time, might mean nothing. But then when we think about what happened in the weekend, the Friday night, 13th July 1978, there was a sighting of a car at the Treetops Hotel where Brenda Page was with customers. Does that have a bearing on this? Of course, Kit Harrison said, don't even know where the Treetops is. I've never been. Couldn't be me. And Dr. Watt also told you, Brenda Page said she was scared of Kit Harrison. Why would Brenda Page tell her that? Sarah McIntyre, the one-time professor at Glasgow, she gave evidence which I suggest might have some weight in the question that you need to determine. And again, something on the face of it might be innocuous, but she told you that she saw an example of the rage of which Brenda Page was so afraid. At a leaving party, he became aggressive and left, but he telephoned to apologise and said he left because he was scared of becoming violent. So there's an example of the rage being observed by someone who's not Brenda Page. Do you believe Dr. Watt when she said that? And if you do, does that assist you in the overall assessment of this case? Dr. Harrison, in his evidence, tells you that he was kind and considerate at all times, that any rage was an inner rage, never expressed. And yet you saw the letter that was put to him, Crown Production 49, in which he acknowledged was his handwriting, which included the sentence that causes those rages of which you are afraid. There it is, in his writing. He did have these rages, I suggest. And when you look at Professor McIntyre's evidence, she saw it. Think about Diane Davey having seen this too. And yet all this is an invention by Brenda Page, according to Dr. Harrison. I invite you to conclude, members of the jury, that he just couldn't bear the thought of her being with another man.
Mr. Prentice then went over the evidence of the previous owner of Allen Street and Brenda's insistence that the door chain was reinstated. Why should she be so concerned about security? And why did she change the lock?
Anne Burt, you'll recall, remembered seeing Dr. Harrison in this and heard Dr. Harrison shouting, "Let me in, B." And this went on for a few minutes. You might think it's hardly indicative of simply knocking on the door and entering. There's a degree of persuasion taking place there, depending on the way in which you look at that evidence. Does that have significance? Perhaps not. You know, for example, that there was a picnic at one point in the Common Green, and that might indicate that, at least on some occasions, Brenda Page was prepared to be in Kit Harrison's company. Again, think about the complex nature of this relationship. Does that undermine the ongoing fear that she had, the ongoing concern and persistent intrusion into her life, or is that all concocted? Apply your common sense.
He then referred to the video interview with the police and Dennis Burt, and although not on oath, he invited the jury to accept that Mr. Burt was telling the truth.
And he told you that on the 13th of July 1978, so it seemed to be a fine night, and he had a real interest in stargazing, so he took his binoculars and he went outside and he noticed lights on in Brenda Page's flat. And he was aware of a person behind the Venetian blinds. Didn't see who it was, quite naturally assumed it was Brenda Page. And presumably didn't really think much more about it. But if you apply the approach I invite you to, don't look at evidence in isolation, think about the evidence of Lorna Milne. And you'll recall that Lorna Milne worked in the Treetops Hotel that Friday, 13th July 1978, and she saw Brenda Page, certainly at 11:45 p.m, may have been later. She gave an account of times that suggested at least that she'd seen her earlier and had left at a later stage, but she seemed to settle ultimately that at least 11:45, she was pretty clear that she had seen Brenda Page in the Treetops Hotel. So if you accept that evidence, Brenda Page is not in her flat at 11:30, I suggest. Somebody else is. Heather Lindsay told you that she saw a green car which looked like Crown Production 109, the Mini Traveller Estate. She's not saying it was that car, but she noticed it. She thought round about 9:40 p.m. What significance is that? Is that a detail where you say, well, there might have been lots of these types of cars around. How do we know that's Kit Harrison's? But if you look at the background, the obsession, I suggest, with her, as he described it, whoring, and I also suggest the idea that he would have no idea that she would go to the Treetops Hotel is implausible. But it's for you to decide. So Heather Lindsay spots this car. James Cook, the taxi driver, remember him, he saw a car that looked like the car in Production 109, which you know from the joint minute is the car used by the accused in 1978. And he noticed it, and he thought it was very untidy inside. And you'll recall that in the police interview, the accused described his car as, quote, "one flying dustbin with a lot of junk in the back," unquote. Coincidence? Of course you might determine, well, I can't be sure, maybe it wasn't his car. But if there's an obsession with Brenda Page, and an obsession with her work, then does that not begin to illustrate to you that he is following her, and he is obsessed with that work? And you'll recall that Brenda Page in Crown Production 64 wrote to the accused in a Dear Kit letter, and he accepted it was her writing, and it included the sentence, "In spite of what you constantly accuse, I am no prostitute." Now, why would you write that if he hadn't said something of that nature? Does that not support this obsession with Brenda Page? And if that's the case, that car, I suggest, was the car of Kit Harrison. Of course, James Cook's timing's different. He thinks sometime after midnight. So you have to resolve that too. You were told that you can pick and choose in relation to assessing the evidence of an individual. So you might find something that you accept and something you don't. You might find that the times don't work at all, or it might be another explanation. But I suggest to you that the car that James Cook saw was indeed that of Kit Harrison. But you'll have to resolve the time. You may take the view the timing just means it wasn't his car, it's some other car. These are all things for you to consider. And bear in mind, and this applies to everyone in the case, no one of the civilian witnesses, at least, goes about their daily business, noting times, writing in diaries, being policemen, noting that so-and-so is standing over there and it's 15:40 in the afternoon and it's a bright sunny day, because I know that in 45 years I'm going to be giving evidence about this, or I'm going to be asked about something in a few days by the police. People don't do that. They recall things. Some things are important to people, some are not. Some people are interested in cars. They notice things like that. Others don't. So keep that in mind when you consider the evidence of the witnesses. It's not all or nothing for a witness's testimony. You may think there's some elements of it you can accept, but the witness may simply be wrong about another detail. These are matters for you to consider.
This is where things can get tricky. The timings don't all match up perfectly, but would you remember a precise time you finished work when asked 45 years on? Even a few days later, especially if you're a taxi driver, travelling to and from the same hotel multiple times in one evening. But what is important to remember is Kit's distinctive, messy car being seen by more than one person outside the hotel that night, and it being missing from his home.
I invite you to conclude that in this case, unlike some cases, sadly, that all the witnesses in this case, led by the Crown, were doing their best to tell you the truth. Sometimes we do have examples in court where it's pretty obvious that a witness is attempting to deceive the court. I invite you to conclude that no one did that here. Reliability is different, because a witness may be doing his or her best to tell you the truth, but just may be unreliable. And the passage of time is a big factor here. You'll recall the comment about the cups being thrown, whether it was a single cup or six occasions or six cups. These are the sort of things that can cause confusion. But if I return to the theme, this background of intrusive pestering, Brenda Page expressing a real fear for her life. The accused, I suggest, regards her escort work as whoring. He expressed an intention to kill her. His car, if you conclude that, is at the treetops. Her flat is entered and she is killed. So what's the link with the murder scene? Again, don't look at the evidence in isolation. There are two sources of scientific evidence in this case. The paint found in the area of the window was discovered to be indistinguishable from a sample taken from Dr. Harrison's car. One explanation could be that it was deposited when a person climbed in. It's not the only possible explanation. And you'll recall you were told about Lockhart's principle, every contract leaves a trace. So this was the point of entry. One explanation is that someone in Kit Harrison's car entered that small window. But if you look at the evidence as a whole, that, I suggest, would allow you to reach a conclusion that that indeed was deposited at that time. Andrew Gibb, the forensic scientist, in a very detailed account of scientific matters, which I hope we were able to lay before you in a manner that was understandable. And he told you about the new techniques which became available over the years in analysing samples. And he used something called SGM plus DNA analysis, and you heard a bit about that. And his conclusions were that he detected DNA types matching the SGM plus DNA profile of Christopher Harrison on items relating to 13 Allen Street, Aberdeen, as, firstly, traces of sperm in stain 1 on the duvet. Secondly, sperm in stain 2 on the, quote, fitted sheet, and as cellular DNA in the same stain. And you'll recall it was described as a fitted sheet, but it's not. It's a simple flat sheet. So sperm in stain 2 in the sheet and as cellular DNA in the same stain. And sperm in stain 18 on the sheet and as cellular DNA in the same stain. Now that cannot be dated. Scientists accepted that. They detected that. Looking at it in isolation, all that tells you, I suggest, is just that. That sperm and traces of sperm were deposited on that sheet. And in addition, you heard of something called acid phosphatase, seminal fluid, which is removed in washing, but it was present here. That in itself does not allow for DNA analysis. But the combination of the acid phosphatase, or AP, and the sperm, applying your common sense, would entitle you to conclude that that's the sperm and that stain containing sperm is a match to the DNA profile of Dr. Harrison. Now, you know, according to Dr. Harrison, no sexual activity occurred at 13 Allen Street between Brenda Page and Kit Harrison, if you believe Dr. Harrison. That's what he said in his interview. He discounts any possibility of any sexual activity of any kind occurring in 13 Allen Street. But I invite you to conclude there was ejaculation at the time of the murder. Now, if you were to strip out this evidence on its own, you can't say when it was deposited. So it's the combination of evidence, I suggest, that allows you to reach that conclusion. The accused need not prove or disprove anything. The burden of proof is on the Crown, but Dr. Harrison does offer as an explanation that the sperm would have been deposited when they were at 12 Mile End Place, 2 years previously. And that Dr. Page had in excess of 50 sheets stored in her flat, and that would account for the sperm.
Kit could have explained the sperm by saying he and Brenda had reconciled the night of the haircut and fish and chips and they'd had sex. But what we haven't heard is what he told the police in the interview in 1978. And he'd have most likely stuck to the story he gave that day. Remember, this is a scientist who had greater knowledge of forensic evidence than any of the police at that time.
Well, the first question you might ask yourselves is, where on earth would these sheets be stored in that tiny flat? 50 sheets. I ask you to reject that. And also to reject the notion that Brenda Page did not launder her bedsheets on a regular basis. And you've some support for that, albeit all these years later, Chris Gannicliffe didn't suggest that the sheets had the appearance of being smellier and not often laundered. Now that brings me to the evidence of Christopher Gannicliffe. You'll recall him. And he performed a supervisory role in reviewing work that had been done, as Andrew Gibb did, and other scientists that you heard about. The two things I'd like you to think carefully about Christopher Gannicliffe's evidence. First of all, in relation to Andrew Gibb and Christopher Gannicliffe, if you determine that they are experts or skilled witnesses, as we sometimes call them, then His Lordship will advise you that they are people who are entitled to express an opinion, because generally speaking, opinions are for you. But his task and that of Andrew Gibb is to assist you in understanding the evidence. And what he did is he reviewed the work which was done. He brought his expertise and experience to bear on the presented evidence and concluded that he could not say that the semen stains were deposited at the time of the attack. But, as I say, I ask you not to look at the evidence in isolation. It could be explained that way. That is one explanation. And he did say that the sheet and duvet cover had not been laundered since the stains were deposited. And the condition of the bedding would suggest that laundering was a relatively frequent occurrence. It's also the case he told you about his expertise in blood spatter analysis. And he explained that it's not the case that an assailant would necessarily be covered in blood when delivering blows with an instrument into something such as a body wet with blood. And he explained that might sound a bit counterintuitive at first, but he explained the research which has been done, which was that when you strike something repeatedly, you may cast blood, but it radiates away from the attacker, so you may not find the attacker covered in blood. He's not saying it could never happen. And there was a significant amount of blood, you heard, in this case. But that leads me to another aspect of his evidence. And you recall he read from his report, which is production 287, at page 96. And bringing to bear the blood pattern interpretation expertise that he had, what he said was, along with his colleague, he looked at this, in our opinion, within the larger bedroom, the deceased had been forcibly struck multiple times to the head whilst in approximately the position she was found on the bed. Now, you know from the joint minute, she was lying down back on the bed and her legs over the bed. For at least some of this assault, the deceased was sat upright at the edge of the bed rather than lying back as she was found. A pattern of several small arc-like impressions in blood on the fitted sheet by the deceased may have been the result of several blows or impacts with a bloody weapon where the blows missed the deceased. So just think about that for a moment. And the whole evidence. At some point she was upright. Now, you know she was in her nightdress. She was not in her nightdress in the Treetops Hotel. So that meant she returned home from the Treetops Hotel and was in the flat and changed into her nightdress at some point. Somebody was in her flat earlier, according to Dennis Burt. You heard that there was at least accommodation within a wardrobe for hiding if someone were to do that. Now, you have to be careful and not speculate. There's a thin line sometimes between a reasonable inference and speculation. But there's no doubt, you might conclude, that she was brutally attacked at a time when she's in her nightdress. Now, there's a range of possibilities for that. If you conclude Kit Harrison had indeed entered that extension through the window. And you know that it was possible because Thomas Gorman, the police officer who said he was of similar stature to Kit Harrison in 1978, and he was able to enter the aperture of the forced window. So it's possible, I suggest. Was that Kit Harrison entering the flat earlier and lying in wait for Brenda Page? Did she see him? Did they engage in something, conversation together, and she get changed? Or did he suddenly appear out the dark as she sat upright at some point on the bed and was struck violently in the manner you have seen in the computer-generated model? The other thing I'd like you to take account of in relation to Christopher Gannicliffe's evidence, and this was also said by Andrew Gibb, and you may consider this to be important, entirely for you, the only matches made with the detectable and interpretable DNA were with Brenda Page and Kit Harrison, no others. What does that tell you? Now, of course, it's often said that absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. So that does not in itself exclude the possibility somebody else was in that flat. However, the only matches made with the detectable and interpretable DNA were with Brenda Page and Kit Harrison, no others. There was other detectable DNA, but it was such low amounts that it was incapable of being interpreted. So we don't know whether it's either Brenda Page or Kit Harrison or some third party. We just don't know. But when you piece together all the evidence that we've had, the paint flake, the stalking, which I suggest was going on, the fear on part of Brenda Page, all these things together, I suggest, allow you to come back, should drive you towards the conclusion that it was Kit Harrison who entered that flat that night. Dr. Harrison went to Edinburgh that day, the 14th of July 1978, and replaced his shoes. Maybe nothing in that. And you'll recall the police officer who later spoke to him noticed the shoes were absolutely brand spanking new. The soles had hardly been scratched. And his watch, a watch Dr. Harrison said he'd had for years, been broken, and that was a good day because he'd finished his work for his doctorate and he could do these things. Or was that watch damaged in the course of the attack? You know, of course, a watch strap was recovered from the fire grate by Brian Kennedy, the police officer, and you know it had a small, very small amount of human blood. That's all we can say. It may have no connection with this case whatsoever. It's for you to determine. But the circumstance of the missing watch, I suggest, and the watch strap being put in the fire grate, do you consider that to have value in assessing this, or is that just unexplained? You may not be able to draw anything from that. The other thing Brian Kennedy said was that having attended at the locus, at Brenda Page's flat, he was instructed to go to speak to Kit Harrison. And he did so with his colleague, and he approached Kit Harrison and he advised him that his ex-wife had died. Dr. Harrison didn't ask, died? Where? When? What circumstances? Was she knocked over? Heart attack? What was it? Now again, you've got to be very careful and apply your everyday experience and common sense. Not everyone is the same in reaction to bad news. Some people are very unemotional and do not express emotion. some people can be very offhand, and it would be easy to misinterpret that as being callous. But do you think it's strange, at least, that he didn't ask for the details or the circumstances of her death? Now, members of the jury, of course, Dr. Harrison gave evidence, and you must take that into account too, and give it full attention, along with all the other evidence in the case. Dr. Harrison's position is that he was kind and considerate and allowed Brenda Page to get on with her life, and that the complaints of abusive behaviour are simply all lies, they're false. Well, you could believe that. He denies being responsible for the murder. If you believe his evidence, of course you must acquit. Even if you don't, but have a reasonable doubt, you must acquit. But let's think about it. Brenda Page has just made all this up, this background abusive behaviour. Well, again, that was something put in writing to a letter, which you might feel has some value, Crown Production 64. It was the letter, undated, sent to Dr. Harrison, but plainly after the graduation, where she puts in writing, "You do nothing but hurt me, let me down and make a fool of me. You're not getting the chance to do it anymore. I don't have to put up with that kind of mental torture or any ridicule. I don't wish to see you ever again. If you do bother me by phone or by calling or by any other kit-type intervention, I will call on the interdict at once." Now, there's a reference to a specific occurrence, and of course you could take the view that's not really about the whole background, that's just about not going to the graduation. Well, she ended that letter, "Just get out of my life and stay out, Brenda." I suggest that accurately reflects how she felt about the relationship. Members of the jury, the Crown never has to establish a motive for murder. And you can understand why that would be, because it can be very difficult to determine. Many murders are committed on the spur of the moment. There may not be a really ascertainable motive. Where there is a motive, of course, is something that the jury can consider. In this case, I suggest that Dr. Harrison was consumed with anger and rage and could not bear that Brenda Page was with another man. He had ability to commit this crime. He was able to climb through the window, as Thomas Gorman demonstrated. And this may be insignificant, Ian Booth told you of an occasion when, in different circumstances and a different window, Dr. Harrison climbed through a window of his home to get in. The targeted nature, I suggest, indicates a rage and an act committed by a man who had recently expressed a desire to kill. Why so many blows? Why 20? When 2 or 3 would have been done if all that was desired was to kill. The history of controlling and abusive behaviour assists, I suggest, in identifying the accused as the perpetrator. The conduct after the crime, does that assist? He goes to Edinburgh and buys new shoes and replaces a watch. There's, on one view, there might be an attempted disposal of a watch strap. He does not ask how or where Brenda Page, the love of his life, died. He had opportunity. He knew the flat. He'd been there. A tool was used to gain entry. Members of the jury, I ask you to fully consider all of these points, and those which occur to you, which I've not mentioned, and those of Mr. McConaughey when he addresses you, and to pay close attention to everything in the case and to the directions which his lordship will give you, I suggest to you that taken as a whole, there is a compelling and convincing case, and that the just verdict in this case is for you to find Christopher Harrison guilty of the murder of Brenda Page. Thank you very much.
Those were the final words from Advocate Depute Alec Prentice that the jury would hear before considering their verdict. It was detailed, thorough, but would it be enough to persuade them beyond reasonable doubt of Kit Harrison's guilt? Before they would retire, they still had the defence's closing speech to hear. In the next episode of the storyteller Naked Villainy, Defence KC Brian McConaughey doesn't hold back in his criticism of prosecution witnesses.
A dangerous witness, in my submission.
He accuses Brenda's friend of lying to the court.
Has decided something and is willing to tailor her evidence to fit that.
And a blistering attack on the Crown's case.
This is very much their last hurrah, and they are throwing the kitchen sink at it, whether it's relevant or whether it's not.
If you've enjoyed this episode, please rate and review, as it makes a huge difference to guiding people to hearing this important story. This is an entirely independent production, and your support is greatly appreciated. And if you want to hear exclusive interviews, longer episodes and insights, please head to the Patreon. The link is in the show notes. Thank you again for listening. This is a piece of history, and you are, for the first time in this format, witnessing justice being done.